So I'll introduce myself. My name is Ron Large, and I teach in the Religious Studies Department at Gonzaga University, which is in Spokane. Mostly I teach ethics. I teach a few other things too, like marriage and that sort of thing, but ethics is my main field. And a lot of what I do deals with issues of war and peace and violence and nonviolence and the relationship between all of those. Before we start, let me mention just a couple of books. Again, for those of you that might not have come earlier, two that I asked the bookstore to order, and then there are a couple others that are already in the bookstore. One is called The Warriors by a man named John Glenn Gray. And as I said earlier, Gray was in World War II and was also had a PhD in philosophy. And the book, he kept a journal during the war. And the book is short excerpts from his journal with an extended commentary on it. It's one of the best personal accounts of war and on a reflective level that I've read. So it's a really good one. Another one is called The Challenge of Peace, which is the U.S. Catholic Bishop's letter on war, mostly dealing with nuclear war. But it's got a really good summary of the just war criteria and what that means and how nuclear war relates to just war, theories of deterrence, and then the role of the church in that. So it's a good short little concise summary of that. And then two others that are in the bookstore. One is called When Is War Unjust? When War Is Unjust, sorry, by John Howard Yoder. Yoder's a Mennonite and a pacifist, and the book is about taking just war seriously, the theory seriously, and asking some of the really hard questions about just war. So that's a good one too. And then another one is by Dr. Seuss. It's called The Butter Battle Book. And it's the story of two nations, I guess you want to use that term, the Yooks and the Zooks. And one butters their bread on the top and the other butters their bread on the bottom. And neither one of them like that. Terms of what the other one's doing. So what happens is you get this, there's something wrong with those people, and there's a sort of an escalating arms race that occurs as each tries to outdo the other. So it's a nice little story. And then I've got a few others, again dealing with pacifism, just and unjust war, and then this one is also a good one by Philip Caputo. It's called A Rumor of War. It deals with Vietnam. Caputo was a Marine lieutenant who went in with the first U.S. Combat forces in March of 1965. And it's also a good personal account, like Gray's as well. The title of today's session is called War, Peace, and Eschatology. I guess I should define eschatology. Should I say a little bit about what that is? Eschatology comes from a Greek word, eschaton, which loosely translated can mean the end or the last times or something to that effect. It's definitely a future connotation. So eschatology is sort of the analysis of that, the understanding of the future. Now that's a little bit different. Another term you'll hear that's related to the end times is this one. We can read that, apocalyptic. Apocalyptic is really a particular form of eschatology. Eschatology is a much broader term. And apocalyptic is a particular type of eschatology. Apocalyptic deals with the end. A lot of it comes from images and themes in the Book of Revelations, and ideas about great struggles and battles and war and that sort of thing. Those are apocalyptic themes that deal with what the future will be like. But that's a specific type of eschatology. Not all eschatology is apocalyptic. Okay. But apocalyptic has gotten pretty popular in the last 50 years or so. I'm going, just a little quick aside here, I'm going to a conference in Edmonton in Canada in October, and I'm doing a paper with a friend on apocalyptic themes in Schwarzenegger's Terminator films. about the last days and the end. The Road Warrior films with Mel Gibson have a lot of apocalyptic images too. But that's what eschatology is. It's a future, an attempt to understand the future, what that looks like, not in terms of a predictive sense, but more specifically, I would argue this for eschatology, the way in which the future gives meaning to the present. And in Christian history and church history, eschatology has been mostly understood in the context of the second coming and what that means. And then there's a lot of variations of interpretation of that. But that's basically the focus of eschatology.
Is this a different word altogether from escalation?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's what I thought was just a takeoff on that when I first saw it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I hadn't thought about it in that context, but they are a lot alike. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
No, but right. And so what I wanted to do first, rather than kind of go through this sort of formally, I have some themes and ideas that I want to present. But I want to ask this question I've got up here. And those of you that have been here for the week and those that haven't, I think one of the key questions that faces Christians and faces the church, and one that's kind of been underneath the surface of everything that I've been talking about and that we've been talking about for the past week now since Monday, really is this question. Should the church or Christians be pacifist? And I thought, at least in terms of as far as my last day here, would be to put that out on the table and just take a look at it. And in some sense, just see what you all think. And as I said, I think that's the key question. I mean, when you get down to, when you cut through all the, you know, all the words and all the images and all the ideas, what's the really key practical question in dealing with war from a Christian standpoint or in the context of the church? I mean, I think really this is it. It's certainly one of the key practical questions. So I thought what I'd do is just kind of throw that out and see what people had to say. And then, as I said, I can kind of maybe organize it a little bit for us. But that's the hard question. That's the key question. Should the church or Christians be pacifists?
Right.
Any takers, Carl? You want to start?
You think of that, the story of turning the other cheek, and that would lead you right to pacifism.
Okay.
I wouldn't talk about it as a war, but the violence that Christ showed when it changed through the money changers out of the temple is a little bit on the other side of the coin.
Well, how so? Say some more about that.
Well, he had absolutely no qualms about picking them up and just pitching them right out.
Okay.
And that was violence.
All
right. That was. It was not violence in the form of war, but it was violent protest.
Well, what do you want to conclude then?
You're saying no, I think.
No, I'm. You mean no as far as best?
Right.
Right.
Okay.
I'm saying I'm in the middle ground.
Well, let's push. What do we mean by pacifism? Let's say something about that too. Maybe that's part of the dilemma that people are facing. In other words, when I ask this question, should the church or Christians be pacifist? I mean, part of the dilemma, it's not a yes or no answer, at least not immediately. And I think part of the dilemma that people face is trying to ask that question. What is a pacifist? So maybe let's say something about that, and then we'll maybe try and answer the question, should the Christians or the church be pacifists? What does it mean to be a pacifist? Well, go ahead, Carl, you drew some implications. Why don't you go ahead and dispel those out a little bit in terms of what that means or what you think it means.
To me, a pacifist is anyone that refuses to participate in the acts of war.
Okay.
Now, they found jobs for pacifists, such as medics in World War II, but That was really to handle the problem after the war had done its damage, at least as far as that individual was concerned. I mean the person he was
right,
serving.
Sure.
But they do not want to be in a position where they have to kill another human being.
Okay, so pacifism is opposition to war.
Okay, can it mean anything else? Or does it mean anything
offer
else?
Something else. It's someone or a Christian pacifist would be one who refuses to kill something or someone in order to save.
Okay, refuses to kill.
Salvation and, is our gift, our responsibility, our goal. But if it requires that we kill or destroy, then, you know, that's too far.
So if somebody refuses to kill for any reason?
In order to save. Okay. You know, in order to achieve the goal, which is, if you want to link it to
salvation,
yeah.
Okay.
Kill in order to save.
Now, obviously, this is a much broader definition.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
So you can
you
say
mean they're willing to kill?
No,
or a pacifist is one. A Christian pacifist would be one who refuses to kill in order to save.
For their salvation. For their own personal salvation. His salvation.
For the salvation of the world, salvation of the individual, salvation of a community, a village, or Vietnam. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe we should define salvation in this case. Because salvation, you know, salvation to me is my life with Christ.
Yeah, yours is a very personal one, but that's part of the Christian message, but we also have the idea of saving the world, which is another part, and linked to the eschatology.
Yeah, so go ahead.
Then you're saying it would be like the conscientious objectors, like in World War II, we had people that were conscientious objectors. Is this what you're talking about?
Well, that might be one way to define pacifism. That's kind of what I'm trying to get at. I mean, are there different levels, different types, or what is your own definition of it?
Yeah.
Now, whether we're going to reach a consensus here, I'm not sure, but I think at least it's important to kind of look at some of the variations that people might have. Sure, go ahead.
I never considered it, you know, that possibly my father fell into that category. He served in World War I. And initially when he went in, he gave fingerprints, and because he was a pharmacist, he became a frontline medic. And so he served on the front line in the First World War, but he did not carry a gun. You know, he was identified as part of the medical corps. Just knowing our family, and then the other thing that happened after that, my father never talked about the war. I didn't know really anything until the Life story came out in sometime in the 60s or 70s. There was a big pictorial thing in Life magazine about World War I. And in one of those pictures, I said, "Dad, that's you." And he said, "No."
Was it him or?
He wouldn't confirm it.
Do you know if the reason, I mean, they put him in the medics because of his pharmaceutical background?
Well, probably because of his medical, you know, because he was from pharmaceutical.
But do you know about his own sort of beliefs on that?
I know that he hunted for food, but, I'm quite sure that, you know, now my father he would be 100 years old if he lived today. So he's, you know, he was in his late 40s when I was born, and so listening to some of the things that you're talking about, all of a sudden, you know, the light went on, and I think very possibly that position was already held.
What else? Other definitions or concepts of pacifism or? Anything else anybody wants to add to that? Sure.
I wondered about the difference between someone who refuses to kill to save oneself, but who might, in other circumstances, kill a third party to save another person. Does that make sense?
Sure.
The parent who would never kill for his or her own safety, but who would not hesitate to kill an intruder who was going to kill their child.
Okay, so, I should write refuse, I guess. So someone who might refuse to, oh, no, you're right, I don't need that up there. Someone who would kill to protect others, but not kill in order to protect themselves. So self-defense then, on a personal level, would not be an option, but they would protect another person. Okay, yeah. Martin Luther says something about that. If we have time, I'll read you a little quote from him. He talks about the role of the soldier. Anything else on pacifism anybody wants to say?
Well, I think we should be clear that pacifism does not necessarily mean conscientious objector. And I'm not sure what the difference is. It probably has to do with conscientious objection being specifically to war, mm-hmm. and pacifism being a larger case that would say, no, I would never kill under any circumstances.
Okay.
But the reason I bring it up is I had some friends from Germany, both East and West, who were conscientious objectors there. And when they, which is possible to do, everybody serves in for the state when they're 19 or something like that. Everyone serves. But if you don't want to serve in the military, you could be a conscientious objector. But they go through intense grilling, and one of the key questions that they have to get through is the questioner would give them specific scenarios. You're walking down the street with your girlfriend and somebody attacks her,
yep.
Would you kill?
Yep.
To say, and that was meant to be a tricking point, like if they answered, well, yeah, I would, well, then they'd say, well, you can't be a conscientious objector, and then they'd say, well, no, it's not. You know, they would have to separate those two issues as being irrelevant to each other.
Okay, so one issue being killing, let's say, down here, or this one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And I would argue that pacifist is one, is the broader.
Okay, who wouldn't kill at all?
At all.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
My father went to prison during, and I don't know which World War, because he was quite old when I was born, but the story that I've heard from my sisters, because he not only was an objector to killing, but he produced pamphlets urging others to also resist enlisting and killing, and because of that was in prison for some time. And he believed in his own religious fervor that the power of God far surpassed the power of evil. And in World War II, one of my sisters told me, because I was too young to remember, told me that Dad believed with all his heart that if Hitler, Mussolini, Roosevelt, etc., could be enclosed in one room with the power of God, that they could come out friends. And that was his absolute ultimate belief.
Let's put that up there.
I condense that.
Yeah. Well, let's just call that. Use your words. The power of God. And I'm not quite sure how to develop that in the sense of only with regard to the faith that can, as you said, kind of bring people, well, reconciliation. Let's use that. Sure, that's a good Christian term. We'll use reconciliation. Okay.
And if we're going to be Christian about the pacifism, I think you have to talk something about the sanctity of life connected in there.
Well, let's put that up here. Sanctity of life. Well, we've got a lot of things going on here, and you can see, I think, some of the different levels. On one hand, you might talk about pacifism as just simply opposition to war. And I mentioned this earlier in the week. The legal status of pacifism is that. In other words, if you're want to claim conscientious objection in the United States,
The legal definition of that is opposition to war. Okay? But you can expand the definition and talk about opposition to, let's just say, well, that would be this one, opposition to any form of killing. Okay? But those two things are distinct, legally distinct. I mean, you might argue that they shouldn't be morally. In other words, you might argue that pacifism really means never killing at all. But the legal status of conscientious objection in the United States is really only this one, opposition to war. That's why your point about the questions that the people were asked, like what would you do if, that's also the title of another book by John Yoder, by the way. Those are inappropriate questions because what they're trying to get at is maybe not only opposition to killing, but opposition to violence. But the real issue with regard to the legal status of conscientious objection is only this one. So it's possible, okay, legally anyway, well, maybe not morally, but it's possible legally to argue this, that you would kill to protect others, but still argue that you'd be a pacifist in terms of opposition to war. I think a point earlier in the week that part of what's going on here, too, is there are different forms of violence, much like we're trying to get at here, different forms of pacifism. So is somebody attacking you and you resist, is that the same kind of violence that we're talking about in war? Or a member of your family? Is that a similar kind of violence such that you cannot be opposed to one and opposed to the other? Or if you accept one, do you have to accept the other? Okay. Or you could, another problem is this. Some people might say, well, pacifists have to be completely non-resistant. Turn the other cheek. Don't do anything. Or passive resistance is another term you'll see. These two things are often used synonymously. Non-resistance and passive resistance. Or can you be a pacifist and still use some kind of what people might call restraining force? Okay. I mean, it's the use of force, but it's certainly, it's not passive, but could you argue that that's really violence? In other words, with the intent to injure someone? So to protect someone else, you might not kill, but you might use force. Okay. So there's a lot of, I don't want to say ambiguities, maybe more complexities is a better way to look at it. So you've got things like force, violence, resistance, non-resistance, war. I mean, all of those things sort of are in the pool or in the mix here.
My example would be that I had a lot of heartburn with Ronald Reagan and his policies in Nicaragua. I did not have heartburn with him doing something with Gaddafi, as an example. So,
well, say why. What's different about one than the other? When you would use violence in each case, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why are they different then?
I just felt that Gaddafi was more of a threat to not only his region, but to the United States and his hatred for us. Whereas I felt the people of Nicaragua, the Contras and the Sandinista argument, whichever side you're on, as it turns out, appears that there was a lot of unnecessary killing, incredible amounts of money spent, and after he left office, it seems like we dropped that country like a hot potato, and we're off onto another tangent, this time on Iraq and dealing with a region of the Middle East. Who knows what the next conflict will be and whether or not I'll agree with it, but just to show you that in the pacifistic type of realm, you might agree with certain war-type actions and others you might not, so it's just to throw out that just because you're a pacifist doesn't mean that, like you said, there might be some kind of restraint-type activity also.
Yeah, you're moving a little bit more closer to the just war theory in that, but you raised a really good point. You said unnecessary killing. And maybe it would be possible to argue you'd be a pacifist on those grounds. But then maybe that gets things a little bit more fuzzy because you're arguing there that there's such a thing as necessary killing or violence and unnecessary. And how do you tell the difference? Is it the magnitude of the threat, Is it something related to American self-interest or security or something like that? Or is it going to be more in terms of a more traditional pacifist would argue that all killing is unnecessary? So I think you can see kind of the complexities that we're trying to deal with. So when I ask you this question, it's still up here, should the church or Christians be pacifist? It's not always an easy answer. Well, see, that's part of the debate, because again, I'll use the legal ramifications of this. Legally, to be a pacifist in the United States in terms of exemption from military service means opposition to all war. Okay. Now, the statute doesn't say anything about opposition to all violence. It simply says opposition to all war. But what you're getting at, you cannot select, well, this war is okay and that war is not. That's really a just war construct. What a pacifist has to hold to be a conscientious objector is complete opposition to war in any form. And that might even be not only simply in terms of opposition, it doesn't say opposition to all killing either. Now you might argue that you're opposed to war because of killing, and killing on a massive scale, whereas other forms, like say killing in self-defense, you might argue you could be a pacifist and hold that view.
It would seem a pacifist, for instance, would be opposed to capital punishment, as well as war.
Okay, what you're getting at here is this one. All killing. Okay, yeah.
We had pacifists in here last week, and the feeling that I got from them was that they're opposed to anything, even including the defense, you know, of ourselves. And having been a member of the defense industry for 30 years, I'm a pacifist, but I'm also a believer in defense. And because, you know, we have to be prepared as the scout, be prepared type thing. And I had real difficulty with that last week. I'm very happy to see you this week.
Well, let me...
There are things... I don't think that there is a... Yeah, people have a right to be way out in the right, and people have a right to be way out in the left. People way out in the left who kill, that's totally wrong. But we do have to establish some kind of a defense for ourselves. So on a personal standpoint, it's easy. But when you're defending a country or a community, it's a different story than defending ourselves.
What's different about it?
Well, you have public property to protect, things that are usable by everyone, not just your own person.
Okay, part of that, what's going on here, is essentially on this level about killing to protect others and understanding war that way. Makes it maybe slightly different in terms of understanding war as just simply an exercise, an expansion, or something like that. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not sure specifically where, but some place I remember Martin Luther writing about the right hand and left hand of God. Yeah. And maybe you addressed this earlier.
Well, let me read you this quote. Luther's it's a complex theology. It's called the Doctrine of the Two Kingdoms that some of you probably will know about. But is the idea is that God works in different ways on different levels. And so for Luther, you get really sort of the temporal kingdom, or what we might call secular reality. And there's also the church kingdom, or the religious reality. Luther's idea was that, and not just Luther, I mean, this is also a part of sort of Christian thinking as well. Sort of this idea of the two realities, two kingdoms. Some it's more extreme than others. Others would talk about a visible and invisible church. And that was the two kingdoms. Others talk about secular and religious reality. And so, I mean, there are variations on it. But let me read you a little bit about what Luther's talking about with regard to war in that light, in terms of how God acts in the world, or how we see God's activity in the world and how that's understood in terms of the nature of that activity. Okay. This is from an essay written in 1526. And the title is Whether Soldiers Too Can Be Saved. And in some respects, that's the same kind of question I'm asking right here. Because why would that be an issue? In other words, what's the significance of that statement, whether soldiers too can be saved? What's the problem?
They're out there killing.
They're out there killing. And which seems to contradict the basic sort of direction or intention of the Gospels, right? And so that's the problem. It seems as if they're doing something that will prevent them from attaining salvation. In other words, that's the issue down here. So in some respects, it's sort of asking the same question I'm asking. Should Christians or the church be pacifist? Luther's just looking at it from a different perspective. Let me read you what he says. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, obviously. It's pretty long. Just a couple of quick quotes from it. The first sentence is this. In the first place, we must distinguish between an occupation and the man who holds it, between a work and the man who does it. So in other words, you separate out the person from their office or their function. An occupation or work can be good and right in itself and yet be bad and wrong if the man who does the work is evil or wrong and does not do his work properly. And he says, when the office is assumed by one to whom it has not been committed, or when one who holds it rightly uses it to gain riches or popularity, then it is no longer good. He says, it is the same way with the profession or work of the soldier. In itself, it is right and godly. In itself. But we must see to it that the persons who are in this profession and who do the work are the right kind of persons. That is, godly and upright, as we shall hear. Okay. So the office of soldier as an institutional structure, according to Luther, is right and godly. The key, then, is putting people into it who understand the nature of that occupation so that they do it rightly and do it in a godly way. Okay, let me read this a little bit further for you here. Here goes back to the question. I want to put it plainly. I am dealing here with questions such as these. Whether the Christian faith by which we are accounted righteous before God is compatible with being a soldier. Going to war, stabbing, killing, robbing, burning, as the military laws require us to do to our enemies in wartime. Is this work sinful or unjust? Should it give us a bad conscience before God? Must a Christian only do good and love and kill no one or never do any harm? The same kind of things you're all talking about here. I say that this office or work, even though it is godly and right, can nevertheless become evil and unjust if the person engaged in it is evil and unjust. So for Luther, the thing that makes warfare wrong or being a soldier wrong is not the nature of soldier or war itself, but the kind of person that's doing it. In other words, they do it the wrong way.
If they enjoy it.
Well, they either like it or they use it for personal gain or self-satisfaction or something like that. They're doing it for the wrong reasons or for the wrong goals or the wrong aims or whatever. And he goes on to say a little bit more. So what is this function? What is the function of the soldier, the office of the soldier? What is it that they're supposed to do? Right? Now let me just read you a little bit on that. He says, the very fact that the sword has been instituted by God to punish evil, protect the good, and preserve peace is powerful and sufficient proof that war and killing, along with all the things that accompany wartime and martial law, have been instituted by God. Okay, the idea of protecting the peace down here, punishing the wicked, that's another thing we didn't put up there, about punishment. He quotes some biblical passages from Romans and 1 Peter to sort of as the biblical basis or foundation for that. What else is war but the punishment of wrong and evil? Why does anyone go to war except because he desires peace and obedience? Now slaying and robbing do not seem to be works of love. And a simple man, therefore, does not think it is a Christian thing to do. In other words, the idea, what he means by simple there is just not looking at it in its complexity. I don't think he means simple in terms of being unintelligent. But if you just look at it on the surface, war seems to be completely contradictory to what the Christian expectations are. And this is Luther's argument. However, in truth, even this, in other words, war, is a work of love. And he uses the example of a doctor who sometimes amputates a diseased hand or foot or something in order to save the whole. Okay? Luther sees war in that same way. Okay? In the same way, when I think of a soldier fulfilling his office by punishing the wicked and killing the wicked and creating so much misery, it seems an unchristian work completely contrary to Christian love. But when I think about how it protects the good and keeps and preserves wife and child and house and farm and property and honor and peace, then I see how precious and godly this work is. For if the sword were not on guard, this is your point, were not on guard to preserve peace, everything in the world would be ruined because of the lack of peace. Okay. Therefore, such a war is only a very brief lack of peace that prevents an everlasting and immeasurable lack of peace. A small misfortune that prevents a great misfortune. That's essentially just war thinking. The idea in just war is that war is the lesser evil to prevent a greater one. And Luther doesn't use those terminology of just war, but that's almost exactly what he's talking about.
The war to end all wars.
Well, the problem, yeah, I think though what Luther would argue though would be that the danger with that is that the war itself becomes the evil. But that's the problem. That's exactly it. How do you know when you reach that point? And Luther says
the World War One was.
Yep.
That's what they said.
Just another quick one here. He's talking about war. People say it's a great plague. All this is true, but they should also consider how great the plague is that war prevents. If people were good and wanted to keep peace, war would be the greatest plague on earth. So the other thing about Luther is very big on sin. Right? Luther writes a lot about sin and the reality of sin and the presence of sin. Okay? And so one of the things that Luther would argue, maybe in the sense of a pacifist, would be this. Would say that, well, you're just simply too naive. You don't recognize the reality of sin in the world and the need to protect the innocent from sin, the sin of others, against them. That would be Luther's argument. So, but what are you going to do about the fact that people will not keep the peace? In other words, not, you know, everybody is not good. But they will rob and steal and kill and outrage women and children and take away property and honor. The small lack of peace called war or the sword must set a limit to this universal, worldwide lack of peace which would destroy everyone. Now that's, so God works that way too.
Yeah, that's right. What I was thinking of, because we initially think of God as a God of love, mm-hmm. and Jesus spoke, you know, agreeing on love and turning to the truth and such, but God is also a God of action and punishing and such, and as God's ambassadors, it would seem that we also have a duty to protect, and as Luther said, they do punish.
Yeah, there's a... The God other problem that... the other problem that it raises, let me read you another quote by him. It'll lead into the next point I wanted to make in a little time. This is another essay called, here it is. In 1525, Luther wrote another essay called Against the Robbing and Murdering Hordes of Peasants. Okay, now this has to do with the rebellion by Thomas Munzer against the German princes, and Luther didn't like this at all. Now he argued that Luther liked order. Luther talks about the orders of creation, right? And there was a sense of orderliness to society. And he was arguing that the Peasants' Rebellion was a disruption of that. That was the evil. That was bringing about the evil. It wasn't looking at, say, the other political issues. Okay, well, let me just read you what he says. The peasants have taken upon themselves the burden of the terrible sins against God and man. They have sworn to be faithful and true and submissive to their rulers, as Christ commands when he says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. I would argue that that's a misinterpretation of that passage by Luther, but that's okay. And now they are deliberately and violently breaking this oath of obedience, setting themselves in opposition to their masters. Now, what does that mean? They have forfeited body and soul as faithless, perjured, lying, disobedient rascals and scoundrels. But listen to what he says.
Those people have conquered, did they?
Okay. He says this, they started a rebellion and are violently robbing and plundering monasteries and castles which are not theirs. By this they have doubly deserved death in body and soul as highwaymen and murderers. For if a man is in open rebellion, everyone is both his judge and executioner, just as when a fire starts, the first man who can put it out is the best one to do the job. Rebellion is not just simple murder. See, this is the hierarchical structure, the orderliness that Luther talks about. It is like a great fire which attacks and devastates a whole land. Therefore, let everyone who can smite, slay, stab, secretly or openly, remembering that nothing can be more poisonous, hurtful, or devilish than a rebel. It is just as when one must kill a mad dog. If you do not strike him, he will strike you and the whole land with you. It's a great passage.
I'd like to hear a debate between him and Bob Hayes.
But that's the other... Yeah, they're both Lutherans, too, which is kind of... well, it's hard to call Luther a Lutheran. I mean, it's not quite... I mean, in the sense that there weren't Lutherans. I mean,
yeah, right.
You know, I mean, that comes just a little bit later, but yeah. Yeah. But... You see the dilemma that's at stake here, and this is maybe another one that relates to the whole issue about pacifism. What is the relationship between church and state? What is Christian responsibility for the state? Do Christians have responsibility for the political process, or what's the level of that responsibility? Is it the same? Are they the same? See, Luther's kind of arguing they're both there. And that's the two kingdom dimension. The problem occurs, and this is where the pacifist point would come in. The problem occurs from a pacifist perspective when the demands of the state become the demands of the church, and the function of the church becomes fulfilling the demands of the state. And so you end up with a church that, I'll just put it this way, simply becomes an apologist for the government. Okay.
As has happened in European
Or you end up with, or you might end up with sort of like a theocracy where this church is the state. Now, what the pacifist is going to make the argument, and this is a point that Yoder begins to make, he's going to make the argument that you have to keep these two realities separate, because the church is really a different kind of institution or community, to use Yoder's term, community, than the state. And the state will do things to defend itself, or even aggression against others, or its own self-interest, which do not match the interest of the church. See, and that's the tension. Think of it this way. If somebody says to you, "What is the church? What is the church? What are the marks by which you recognize its presence?" In other words, how do you tell it's there? What do you look for? Luther talks about marks of the church. In other words, things that you can point to say, oh, if those things are present, then the church is present.
I think a big thing that you would see would be suffering.
Okay.
And I don't think you see much of that in this country. And I think you'd see a lot more of it if the church took a more pacifistic stance.
All right.
I don't know. I mean, if you try and base it on the Gospels, which is Christians, I think we should.
Yeah.
Christ talks about unconditional love. And I kind of think that just says it all. I mean, we're getting an intellectual discussion here, and I don't think you're going to find all the answers.
Yeah.
But I think if you look at Christ's unconditional love, that umbrellas it all. You know, and the only law that we are supposed to live by now is the law of charity, the law of love.
All right, so what does that say about this relationship, then?
I think they are separate. I would agree with the other on that. No. I think we have a responsibility to the community, to the state, but it is a separate body. The church is a separate body, and I think you're going to see that division if we take a more Christ-like stance, I believe.
Okay.
To your question of how do we, what are tangible things that we see that indicate the church is there, tangible as a group of people gathering for worship.
Okay, worship.
And groups of people helping each other. I just started thinking back to the earliest churches and what they were like. And reading Luther and his emphasis on hierarchy seems completely opposite to the original church, which was no hierarchy, and everyone in there was equal. We were all one.
Yeah, Luther talks about word and sacrament as marks of the church, where the word is preached and the sacraments are administered.
Well, his rebellion wasn't so much to the outlook of the Catholic Church as to how they were ministering to
yep,
the people.
Yep, that's right.
But, you know, if you stop and think about the United States and the 200 plus years that we've been here, the people that came and have inhabited this nation have come from a variety of countries, many for religious freedoms. And because of that, because the countries that they were in, the church had become the state. And so in our Constitution, it specifically says that we will separate church and the state. I think what's happening today, in today's world, is that in the state, they are claiming almost too much as influence of church. I mean, you know, they want to abolish anything. And actually what they're doing is they're abolishing our religious freedom.
Okay. Well, there is that certainly that sense of freedom there.
And because the United States is a world conglomerate, we are a nation of people from all countries. We are kind of the people who have escaped oppression elsewhere.
Carl, were you going to say something?
All I was going to say is that we got to be careful that we don't get into a position where the church stands off to one side and says, I don't have anything to do with this, you know. I'll be willing to take the protection of the state, but I don't want to provide any of it.
Well, would they even have to do that? I mean, could they say, I'm not going to take your protection? I mean...
Well, the only way they could say, I'm not going to take your protection, would be to leave the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, isn't that kind of what Paul was recommending Corinthians? I just read weeks ago where he's saying, stay away, you know, draw onto yourselves, stay apart from society, don't enter public life. Do your own work and stay within your own community.
Well, there's clearly...
But then what you're doing is... you're still taking the protection of the state. Because even though, you know, we can isolate ourselves, for instance, up here at Holden Village. Mm-hmm. And yes, we could probably exist for quite a long time without any of the effects of the state of Washington or the United States or anything. But eventually, anything that harms the state of Washington or the United States will affect us. So we have just said, let someone else protect us. Yes, we would like to think we want that we're going to put all our faith in the protection of God. And unless we're willing to die for that, then we are leaving the dirty work up to someone else. And that's where I say that's wrong.
Let me put up one more term.
No.
It's discipleship. Go ahead.
I think that letting someone else do our dirty work would be, for us, would be wrong also. I also think it would be wrong that for us to just sit there and let the evil overtake us is a greater sin. It's very cowardly. But I think we are supposed to react, but to react in a loving way. Just a little example that just happened to me the other day. It's kind of funny. A friend here on staff, we were just cutting up and kidding around, and I just criticized her and in a joking way, and she just came over to me to just, you know, just to hit on me just a little bit. And I reached out and I hugged her and I took all her defenses away, you know. I completely sapped the offensiveness of her, you know, coming at me away, and I think that would work on any scale. You know, Christ says to reach out in love, and certainly God, you know, there is always going to be wars because God is going to either allow these things to happen or cause them to happen. But He does this, God does this in order to glorify God's own name, and He's looking for our response. And I think that needs to be a response of love, to reach out to that person, actually, and hold on to them and show them that we do love you.
I think that we have to participate in the state, but not be the state. In other words, like the princes in Luther's time in Germany, you know, if that prince believed in this type of religion, then everyone in his kingdom had to be that part of the religion. We don't want that in the United States. Our Constitution wants a separation of that. But it does not say that the Christian can't be part of the state and part of the control of the state.
You know, complete your side of it. You've got church and state. On top of that, you need to put Christian and citizen. You know, individual, the individual.
Christian over here and citizen over here.
Right.
Are they two separate realities?
And that is exactly the point. You can't radically separate.
Okay.
In fact, you know, what come to your point of eschatology is to somehow erase the difference. The Christian's hope is that the state will not lay upon him things that are counter to his or her religion. And vice versa, the church, you know, our hope is that we can make the state as holy a place, and our citizenship as natural, an outcome of our faith as possible. So, you know, the intent is always to marry these two that are radically separate.
Yeah, well, one of the things that Yoder talks about, and other pacifists as well, and pacifists have been accused of being sectarian, in other words, wanting to withdraw, to become isolated. And, you know, Yoder and other pacifists, you know, argue against that. I think what they fear is that the church gets caught up so much in the demands of the state that it loses its identity as church. And that's why I wanted to put discipleship up here. Because one of the other things that Luther talks about as a mark of the church, he talks about word and sacrament, and then he talks about sort of like living a Christian life. And I've just used the term discipleship as a you know, sort of one single word to capture that. And somebody mentioned Bonhoeffer, you know, a little while ago. You know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's famous book, you know, The Cost of Discipleship.
which is really an exegesis of the Sermon on the Mount. He goes through Matthew 5 through 7 in there. But at the same time, you get Bonhoeffer's participation in one of the plots against Hitler. But Bonhoeffer struggled with that a lot. If we had time, we'd talk more about Dietrich. But Bonhoeffer talks about what he called the ultima ratio, which means sort of the final act. But you can never allow that final act, which he meant violence, to become a policy. And that was the thing that he feared. That by stepping over that boundary between sort of killing and not killing, that killing would become simply an acceptable thing to do. And he never wanted that to occur. So that, if you read his book, Ethics, he talks about this in there. Last comment, and then we'll stop, since we're running out of time.
I think the thing that comes to my mind is the last thing that really tore apart our country historically was the Civil War. That was approximately 140 years ago. Abraham Lincoln wrote some great words of wisdom along those lines. Here we are in 1991. My feeling is, and I believe this very strongly, is that this whole scenario might change very dramatically, church and state, citizenship, etc., if the war comes to our shores. Let's hope it never does. Most of our wars have been fought somewhere else. We have not yet been attacked, you know, other than Pearl Harbor. And lest we never forget that, I think this whole scenario would change very dramatically if that was to happen.
In what way?
Just from the protection of our own fellow brothers, our sisters, our husbands, our wives. I think you'd see a lot of camaraderie all of a sudden, and a lot of things might just be put down by the wayside. All of us.
Let me finish up by making one other quick point that Gray talks about. The other side of this is John Glenn Gray's book, The Warriors. The other side of this issue about war, peace, and eschatology is some of the things that Gray talks about, that why we find war kind of fascinating. And I'll just throw these out to you since we're running out of time, but they're in Gray's book, and if you buy the book, you can read them. Gray talks about three appeals of battle, and on a personal level. One, he talks about the delight in seeing. In other words, looking and watching. He talks about an episode sitting up on a hill in Italy with a hermit. And there's an artillery battle going on down below in the valley. And he's trying to explain to this hermit what's going on. The hermit doesn't understand this. Who's fighting? What's happening? And it's just like he becomes detached from it, and they just kind of look at it. And Gray talks about that being war takes you out of the ordinary. It certainly is something to see. To look at. There's another essay by a guy named William Broyles, who was a Marine lieutenant in Vietnam, and he has an essay titled Why Men Love War. And he talks about this too, the interest in seeing. The second thing that Gray talks about is the delight in comradeship, that sense of solidarity and trust and loyalty. And Gray argues that's the most powerful, not inducement to war, but the most powerful kind of sensibility in warfare. And Broyles also talks about that in Vietnam. The third one that Gray talks about, which he argues is the most troublesome, is what he calls the delight in destruction, where war simply becomes a mechanism of killing for its own sake. And he talks here about war then becomes sort of ritualized, and killing becomes a sacred act. Once you get to that point, Gray argues, we're in real trouble. The first two, you know, he can kind of deal with. But part of the problem, I think, is precisely confronting that reality in terms of the understanding what war is, what it does, how it works, what people think about it, feel about it, and then what peace, in a sense, means and what that does in terms of our future. Well, we got to stop. We're out of time. Since there's no first lunch today, we're not late for lunch, but it's time to stop. I don't know if they're still taping or not, but you all can stop the tape now. Oh, go ahead.